In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict: there is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. All right, so first few verses, we've got the description of the king and his kingdom and where this story is taking place. As we discussed in the first class that we had, this Ahasuerus is generally recognized by historians as Xerxes I. We actually see the name Ahasuerus in elsewhere in the Bible, Ezra chapter 4 and Daniel chapter 9. But if you start looking at the timelines, you can quickly find out that this is not the same guy. That was most likely a guy by the name of Cambyses, who was the second Persian emperor, the immediate successor of Cyrus the Great. This Ahasuerus is distinguished by reigning from India to Ethiopia. And if we look at the maps and the timelines and all that, we can determine that this is Xerxes that we talked about in our first class.
Was that a Hebrew distinction that they go by the name of Ahasuerus?
It could be. I don't really know. It could just be a title. We're not really sure. So, he's ruling from his palace here in Susa, and the Hebrew word here for this palace is Bira, which means it's more accurately translated as fortress. So he's in the midst of a fortress, and this is actually a whole palatial section of the city. It's not just his palace, but it's also the gardens, the grounds, the outbuildings, and other homes. So we'll see that this same word is used in the next chapter, chapter 2 and verse 5, that Mordecai actually lives within this section of the city. It's just more heavily fortified area than the rest of it. So in the third year of his reign, we have some corroborating sources from the Greek historian Herodotus. He is not really a contemporary with Xerxes, but he's close enough that he's generally considered to be a pretty accurate historian. And he talks about this party that Xerxes throws, where he's planning to invade Greece. He's planning to attack within a couple of years, and he throws this 6-month-long feast for his guests. He's quoted as saying at this banquet, "As Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius have enlarged the empire, I wish to do the same. I propose to bridge the Hellespont, march through Europe, and fire Athens. By reducing Attica and Greece, the sky will be the only boundary of Persia." So he has these visions of grandeur, and he believes he's the guy to expand the empire. And so that's what this party's for. He's drumming up support for this invasion. Back to the Hebrew, the word for this feast is, I'm going to butcher it here, Mesheta. And it comes from a root word meaning, does anybody want to take a guess at this?
Mesheta.
Mesheta.
Is that the Hebrew word for anoint?
No. Okay. Close. No. It's the Hebrew word for to drink wine. So it gives you an idea of what kind of party this is. 6 months of it, And then this last final 7 days is like the party of the party. It's the big blowout bash here at the end. Everybody's invited. We've got royalty. We've got government officials. We've got military leaders, prominent citizens, the whole lot. And, you know, we don't really know exactly how many guests there were, but it was certainly in the hundreds, probably in the thousands. People rotating in probably from all over the empire, all those satraps. There were 127 provinces, all had their own government. He's bringing them all through here to kind of show off his grandeur. So, like I said, this is the final 7 days. We've got this major party. It's kind of interesting to read the description, how precise it is about all the things that he had there at the party. I guess it's verse 6. It runs through just the opulence of what we have here. And why do you think that is? Why are we seeing such description here? Why is it giving us this description of, you know, mother of pearl, fine linens, and, you know, all this sort of thing?
I would imagine that these things come from very diverse regions. You can't just get them all in one, in, you know, just in Persia. But as the kingdom has spread, they've been able to acquire additional resources and sources to get these materials.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just to show his power. I heard somebody say it. You know, he had this sense that he was God incarnate, that he was God on earth. Okay. Yeah, and this is a way to impress upon the country that he is this guy that they want to throw their support behind, because raising a million-man army to march on Greece, it's going to take some money, it's going to take some support, and he needs that from all these people that he's invited. Go ahead.
I was just going to simply say that clearly this Xerxes has got an ego. He demands respect. He's very severe, and he is putting on the display of his power, which I think in the detail is an elaboration of why the Queen Vashti, who stood him up and refused the king, nobody does that. And so you can see why she was deposed. I don't know why he didn't do her off, quite frankly, but she survived, and he picked a new queen. And you can see why now.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. I think, to your point, the ego thing is also maybe a reason why he's lavishing all this. He's convincing himself that to this point he really hasn't done anything spectacular. He hasn't conquered really anything of note. So I think this could be a way of kind of stroking his ego as well. So, yeah.
You know, there some question the canonicity of this book, and one of the arguments is that there's no way that he would throw a party for half a year. But I think you just presented one historian, anyway, contemporary, who said that this occurred. So I thought that significant.
Yeah. Herodotus is generally thought of to be fairly accurate. There are things that he wrote that, you know, that don't quite match up with what really happened, but for the most part, he's pretty spot on most things. So, a couple of notes. Typically in these feasts, there were rules about drinking. In fact, there was a law. It was called the Law of Ritual. And basically, it said that everybody would drink kind of like a toast, like when the king or whoever was giving a toast would, you know, order it. Everybody would raise their glass and drink. But what does it say in verse 7 and 8? There's no compulsion. Every man would do as he wished. So what does that suggest to you about this party? And this is what? This is a debauch. This is a free-for-all. The most powerful man in the world at this time. He's throwing this free-for-all party, no budget, drink to your heart's content, and it's been going on for 6 months, and now this, you know, ultimate party for 7 days. These are idolatrous people, too. So you've got to imagine that the levels of, you know, hedonism and degeneracy that are going on here are things we may not be able to imagine what was going on there. But it's got to be pretty crazy in there. Did y'all have any more comments on these first eight verses? Any thoughts? Okay, well, let's move on, and we're going to read the next few verses. Chapter 1, verse 9 says, Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. All right. So probably the first time in his life that he's been told no, right? Here we are, final day of the event. He's trying to make himself look like this god king. His heart's merry with wine, and this is the grand finale. Everybody there is probably just totally drunk, yeah. And, of course, the women are having their feast somewhere else in the palace. Vashti's name, according to some translations, means either beauty or best. Some have speculated that this probably wasn't her real name. It's more of like a term of endearment. We don't know. But that could be why there are actually no historical records of her anywhere, no corroborating sources. Vashti, the only place we hear about her is here in this Book of Esther. Other historians have recorded different names for the queens that Xerxes had. So this is another thing that the skeptics like to point to as saying that Esther is more a book of fiction, that there is no Queen Vashti, but like I said, it could have been a term of endearment.
So we don't know what nationality or where she came from. What?
Vashti?
Yeah.
We don't know. We would assume that she was Persian, but we don't know. The empire was so huge. Yeah. She could very well could have been foreign.
She had some reason.
Yeah. It's possible. It's clear, though, that she was a beautiful woman, and being the type to show off what he has, you know, Xerxes orders his servants to go get her and bring her into this hall where all the men are, and they've been drinking and carousing for 7 days straight. Everybody's drunk. And so it's not a consensus thing, but a lot of the Jewish scholars of the Talmud, they suggest that when it says there that for her to appear before them wearing her royal crown, that it was actually her crown and nothing else. That's not the consensus view, but a lot of the scholars do point to that. And that kind of changes your perception of her a little bit. I've always kind of wondered, you know, why refuse the king, you know, if this is just a thing where he's commanding you to come. I mean, what point is it to say no? But this kind of makes a little more sense, doesn't it?
The rabbit hole I go down is what was proper. I mean, we've talked about what rules these folks have. We talk about rules of
presence and all, and he's doing this from a drunken stupor request. Would he have done this or even considered doing this? So that's where my mind goes down, but I have no other scripture or other historically to back it up. But I just totally out of place, inappropriate, not protocol, and they seem to either say they're going to break the rules, and otherwise they're going to follow rules of protocol.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what other culture or civilization would you ever see a monarch behaving like this? You know, it just... well, publicly. but, yeah, you know, that changes my thoughts on her. That would be humiliating for any woman, but especially a queen. And, you know, the people from all over the empire are here at this party. So if that happens, I mean, it's immediately going to be known everywhere that she did this. She's going to lose a lot of respect across the kingdom. So, you know, it makes sense why she would refuse him. She turns him down. We don't know exactly why. Now, like I said, that's not the consensus view. There could have been another reason why she actually turned him down. Maybe she was just a jerk and just didn't want to do what he said, wanted to humiliate him in front of his friends. We don't know. It does appear to me that his request is some kind of a degradation of some sort. So we do know that this now sets Xerxes off. We already discussed how he was prone to outbursts of rage, and I'd imagine that was especially true when he was drunk. So, any thoughts on further thoughts on this? These few verses. Yeah.
But we look at how at the end of the book how he responds to wise advice. So it just, that's all I'll go into the future of the book, but. Yeah. He's not totally a lunatic.
Yes, we do. There's some redemption there, I guess, towards the end. But we do see more of this kind of, you know, rash, impulsive behavior that carries on throughout this story. Anything else? All right, moving along pretty quick here. All right, we're going to read through the rest of the chapter here. Starting verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in the law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of the king Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice had pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, to every people in its own language, that every man may be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Wow. All right. So you've got this volatile, impetuous king. He's just been humiliated in front of all his guests, crushing his image he has of himself and embarrassing him at a time when he's needing this support. And so he doesn't really know what to do about it, does he? He's kind of at a loss. Like I said, this is probably the first time he's ever been refused. So he turns to his wise men, kind of his cabinet, I guess, and he asks them what we should do with the queen. What does the law say you can do? You know. And so what do we see? We see this one of his friends kind of come up with this. It's just kind of weird. This kind of idea that her behavior is going to spark some kind of like feminist revolution across the empire. What does this look like to y'all? Is this? I mean, are they really worried about the women, you know, rising up and being disobedient, or what?
Well, all we know is the king was severely disrespected.
If the queen can refuse and reject and disobey the most powerful man in the land, I guess the speculation was that others would follow suit.
Could get all over the kingdom when they didn't have media to put out on.
You'd be surprised, actually. The Persians actually had a very interesting, I guess, mail delivery system. It was very much like the Pony Express. We'll actually talk about it here later. When orders do go out to all the kingdom, they would have riders that would, you know, take off on one horse, get to several miles down the road, and swap horses, and they could, within a couple of days, they could have the word out across the whole empire. So, but
the people just talk.
Yeah. If it didn't happen in a few days, it was sure to happen when these people returned home from their party, wherever they were going, within a few months. So,
correct me if I'm wrong. Going from memory here, I think I've read too that the other piece of this was he didn't want the men of their individual households to stay behind. He's about to go invade Greece and whatnot, and so the idea was, hey, you're the man of your household. I need you to come fight. Don't let your household, your wives, your whatever, say you can stay behind.
That's a good point. That's a good point, yeah. That could have played into it. You know, he needs all the support he can garner at this moment in time. This is a huge campaign that he's about to embark on. He doesn't need disgruntled families and wives, you know, trying to hold the men back. So, I think part of it, too, is kind of just a cover-up for the king's rage and pettiness. Like, you know, they're making about Vashti when, you know, it really should have been about him. Like, he's been drunk and he's flipped out. Made this order for her to come and, you know, show herself, expose herself to all the men of the kingdom. That looks bad. I mean, looks bad now. It looked bad 3,000 years ago. I mean, it's just a bad thing. So they've kind of controlled the narrative here and made it about her behavior and made it into this thing about controlling the women of the empire. I think all of that we've talked about has kind of plays into it.
Probably don't have the answer, but I wonder if it opened up something for the men in their households, because it says it is that all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. So by his action, what he did with Vashti, did it now open up where these men could do something in their households? You know, because you asked just a moment ago, should they have been threatened? Well, if you're threatened by undermining your power, you're going to take action to do that. So you think about so many laws or rules that have been written in all of our humankind history. People who had fear put laws to protect themselves because they inferiority and or, you know, not the ability to defend. They had to cheat to keep their position. So,
yeah, I think all that comes into play. Anyway, he decides to put her away and publicly decree that She can never come before him again and loses her position as queen. It's mentioned here, and you'll recall from the first class, the law of the Medes and the Persians. What was that? That was the law that governed the empire. Do y'all remember what it said? Yeah. Once the proclamation is made, not even the emperor can go back on it. It's the law, and it's staying the law. And so this is permanent. There's no going back from this. So when they depose her, she's gone. We don't really know whatever becomes of her. Jewish tradition believes that she actually did end up executed at some point. That is very, very probable. If you look at the history and just what happened to deposed monarchs of the time, you know, that is very likely that she probably didn't survive this. We just don't know. So. Okay, so here we are. We've gone through, we've blazed through the first chapter here. Do we have any more comments here? Do we have maybe some lessons that we can take from this? I know we're just getting into the book, but... Yeah, don't make the king mad. We've got... a few things. Don't make the king mad is very obviously the first one. I think just looking at Xerxes himself, you know, this is just impetuousness, you know, just the way a leader should lead. You know, it's just when you're without God and you're just... I don't know. You're making decisions drunkenly. I mean, those are pretty clear. But you know, the way that a leader should comport themselves. This is a pretty clear case of what not to do. So, okay. Well,
to go with him if he was planning war to be with him. Mm-hmm.
What?
Oh, I said he was trying to get them all on his side to when they go. He'd go to war. He needed them to go with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, people will follow. The might, the power. They'll look at the wealth and the opulence. But does that make a good leader, really?
Sorry, Michael. Oh, sorry. Looking back in verse, well, just to your comment, Bill, looking at verse 8, talking about people without God and the depravity of that, I guess. Mm-hmm. You can't help it, for me anyway, you can't help but think when he says, where was it? To do as each man desired. It reminds me of the time of the judges. There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And obviously the debauchery that went along with that. So just your point around without God.
Yeah, when man is left to his own devices and there's no limits, and there's no authority, we see it descends into just absolute chaos. And, you know, situations like this arise where... the queen of a nation has now been thrown out and just a huge mess.
Do we know anything in terms of the stature of Xerxes, like what he looked like, his character, what kind of character he was?
Well, there's a lot written about him. As far as physical, like, appearance, I haven't run across anything. Not to say that there isn't. There's in fiction, historical fiction, movies, stuff, he's, displayed differently. I don't have a physical, like, if he was big or if he was a, short guy or what. We see a lot... about his character based on the actions that he takes throughout history, not only here in Esther, but a lot of the corroborating historical stuff, that he was very rash and very prone to just making really kind of bad decisions, quick, hasty decisions, not thought through. So we know that about him.
I was just thinking, this is probably a very unique chapter in the Bible in general. I know we mentioned there's no God in the book. The word God references to him praying in the whole book. But even in this chapter, there's no Jews. There's no, there is nothing. This is not a standard biblical chapter in the Bible. And, I think there's a picture painted here of hedonistic ways of living that are probably not found anywhere else in the Bible either. And we may be giving a lot of credit to how clearly these men were thinking to control their war or to make the king look good. I mean, that may have been part of it, but, I picture more of a pub-type merriment scene in, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or something, where, big men are, dancing around and being merry and not thinking. And I don't know, maybe that's not exactly right, but that's the image that I get from this. And there isn't a lot of good decision-making going on in that environment.
I think you're right on point there. I think this is like a week of Las Vegas bachelor party with no limits, no budget. I mean, just madness all around. And Albert.
I haven't vetted this, but I was just looking at marriage or vows or something in Persian. I found an article written in January 30th, 2020, Women in Ancient Persia. Again, I haven't vetted it. It's secular, but it just says women in ancient Persia were not only highly respected, but in many cases considered the equal of males. Women could own land, conduct business, receive equal pay, could travel freely on their own. In the case of royal women, hold their own council meeting on policy. So we may have a cultural thing to where this women party wasn't a submissive like you would see in Hollywood and they're just sitting there idly by. They talk about conducting business. They had actual military assignment. Again, I haven't vetted it, but it does throw something at me here.
Well, it kind of match up with some of the other things that I've read about the Persians, where there was no, there weren't really any distinctions as far as like race or anything like that. Like everybody was considered fairly equal, as long as you were submissive to the emperor. You paid your taxes. You didn't rebel.
Which is why they had their
own kings
too.
Yeah.
If that were to be the case, then I would imagine that, so Queen Vashti is overseeing the women's party, right?
Yeah.
So she's in a position of leadership over that party where they're making or having these, probably it's possible that this is in high contrast to the king's party where you see all the drunkenness and debauchery and things like that. Either way, by him commanding her to come to him, potentially in just the headdress or whatever way it may have been, that would have potentially undermined her authority and position, coming, interrupting her position of leadership at the other party.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think this was definitely going to be something that she couldn't come back from. She would lose all manner of respect and like I was saying, this would be something that would immediately go out all over the empire as look what the queen did, how could she do this humiliating kind of event. So anyone else? These are good thoughts. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say a little bit as to what my perception is to his character based off of these actions. I mean, we clearly see, I brought up the stature thing because I wanted to say it seems like he's got a clear Napoleon complex here. And I was just joking, but he kind of does. He's stroking his own ego. He's trying to make a god of himself. It's all about the showmanship. You go back to all of the things that were in the palace. Clearly, he's got the best of everything. I see him you know, taking these people around and showing him the curtains and the couches made of gold and sit in this and, you know, I'm better than you on every single level. And they're getting to the end of this party and he still needs to feed his ego and feel better than everybody there from all these different provinces all over the, you know, the territory. And he's like, okay, let's bring my wife out and let me best them again. And so it's just a clear kind of lesson on when you get caught up on the desires of the flesh in whatever form that they may come, they certainly do feed your ego, but they certainly always end in disaster.
And it keeps going too, like, you know, I've got this and then I've got this and then I've got, you know, you keep chasing after more and more, and it's never sated. So yeah, and also, you know, we know that he thought himself a god. We mentioned this earlier. There's some quotes from him, especially dealing with the Greeks, where he kept trying to convince them to throw down their arms because he was God on earth and you couldn't fight against God. And of course, it didn't really work out for him. He got whipped and thrown out of Greece within a few years, and that's actually where chapter 2 is going to pick up. We have several years, actually, between chapter 1 and 2. There's the preparation for the Greek campaign. It takes about 2 years. And then the Greek campaign itself, I think it takes maybe 3 years. So it's like a five-year break here in between chapter 1, chapter 2. He comes back. He's, you know, clearly depressed. You know, he doesn't have a wife. He's just blown it in his military campaign. And so the servants have to come up with some way to kind of get him, you know, out of his funk. So what do? They got start looking for his a new wife. So, okay. Any other thoughts or comments? Terry.
It just goes to show the power of God in all of this and his wisdom and infinite power of the times, even when the king of Persia looked to his wise men for counsel, that in the perilous times, God still sets things up for his own plans. It cannot be underestimated, God's power in all of this. Even though it may not say God as far as name written in that, but it's all there. It's complete.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Terry. That is going to be, I think, the central theme of the book. You know, God can use whatever situation. In fact, he may even set it into motion himself for the salvation of his people, to do his will. Even in this world of, you know, idolaters and tremendous power, he uses it to you know, for the benefit of his people. So, good lesson for us to remember even today. So, okay, anybody else? Well, I think that was the first bell. We've got a few more minutes, but that's about it for me, unless anybody else has anything. We'll pick up chapter 2, John, on Sunday, jumping ahead a few years. All right. Thank you very much.